story, encoded in a grim little fable. But more bizarrely than that, she'd folded the listener into the tale, and even the telling of the tale itself, creating a circle impossible to break because all of its constituent elements were trapped inside. Was it that sense of entrapment that had so distressed him as a child? Pye had another theory, however, and was voicing it from across the years.
"No wonder you were so afraid," the mystiff said, "not knowing what the crime was, but knowing it was terrible. I'm sure she meant no harm by it, but your imagination must have run riot."
Gentle didn't reply, or rather, couldn't. For the first time in these conversations with Pye, he knew more than history did, and the discontinuity fractured the glass in which he'd been seeing the past. He felt a bitter sense of loss, adding to the distress he'd carried into this room. It was as though the tale of Nisi Nirvana marked the divide between the self who'd occupied these rooms 200 years before, ignorant of his divinity, and the man he was now, who knew that the story of Nisi Nirvana was his mother's story, and the crime she'd told him about was the act that had brought him into being. There could be no more dallying in the past after this. He'd learned what he needed to know about the reconciliation, and he couldn't justify further loitering. It was time to leave the comfort of memory, and Pye with it. He picked up the bottle of beer and struck off the cap. It probably wasn't wise to be drinking alcohol at this juncture, but he wanted to toast the past before it faded from view entirely. There must have been a time, he thought, when he and Pye had raised a glass to the millennium. Could he conjure such a moment now and join his intention with the past one last time? He raised the bottle to his lips and, as he drank, heard Pye laughing across the room. He looked in the mystiff's direction, and there, fading already, he caught a glimpse of his lover, not with a glass in hand, but a carafe, toasting the future. He lifted the beer bottle to touch the carafe, but the mystiff was fading too fast. Before past and present could share the toast, the vision was gone. It was time to begin. Downstairs, Monday was back, talking excitedly. Setting the bottle down on the mantelpiece, Gentle went out onto the landing to find out what all the furor was about. The boy was at the door, in the middle of describing the state of the city to Clem and Jude. He'd never seen a stranger Saturday night, he said. The streets were practically empty. The only thing that was moving was the traffic lights.
At least we'll have an easy trip, Jude said.
Are we going somewhere?
She told him, and he was well pleased.
I like it out in the country, he said. We can do what the fuck we like.
Let's just make it back alive, she said. He's relying on us.
No problem,
Monday said cheerily.
Then to Clem, look after the boss man, huh? If things get weird, we can always call on Irish and the rest.
Did you tell them where we are? Clem said.
They're not going to fetch up looking for a bed, don't worry, Monday said. But the way I reckon it, the more friends we got, the better.
He turned to Jude.
I'm ready when you are, he said,
and headed back outside.
This shouldn't take more than 2 or 3 hours, Jude told Clem. Look after yourself. And him.
She glanced up the stairs as she spoke, but the candles at the bottom threw too frail a light to reach the top, and she failed to see Gentle there. It was only when she'd gone from the step and the car was roaring away down the street that he made his presence known.
Monday's come back, Clem said.
I heard.
Did he disturb you? I'm sorry.
No, I was finished anyway.
The night's so hot, Clem said, gazing up at the sky.
Why don't you sleep for a while? I can stand guard.
Where's that bloody pet of yours?
He's called Little Ease, Clem. And he's on the top floor, keeping watch.
I don't trust him, Gentle.
He'll do us no harm. Go and lie down.
Have you finished with Pye?
I think I've learned what I can. Now I've got to check on the rest of the synod.
How'll you do that?
I'll leave my body upstairs and go travelling.
That sounds dangerous.
I've done it before, but my flesh and blood'll be vulnerable while I'm out of it.
As soon as you're ready to go, wake me.
I'll watch over you like a hawk. Have an hour's nap first.
Clem picked up one of the candles and went to look for a place to lie down, leaving Gentle to take over his post at the front door.
He sat on the step, with his head laid against the door frame, and enjoyed what little breeze the night could supply. There were no lamps working in the street. It was the light of the moon and the stars in array around it that picked out the details in the house opposite and caught the pale undersides of the leaves when the wind lifted them. Lulled, he fell into a doze and missed the shooting stars.
4.
Oh, how beautiful, the girl said.
She couldn't have been more than 16, and when she laughed, which her beau had made her do a lot tonight, she sounded even younger. But she wasn't laughing now. She was standing in the darkness, staring up at the meteor shower, while Sartori looked on admiringly. He'd found her 3 hours earlier, wandering through the midsummer fair on Hampstead Heath, and had easily charmed himself into her company. The fair was doing poor business, with so few people out and about, so when the rides closed down, which they did at the first sign of dusk, he talked her into coming into the city with him. They'd buy some wine, he said, and wander. Find a place to sit and talk and watch the stars. It was a long time since he'd indulged himself in a seduction. Judith had been another kind of challenge entirely, but the tricks of the trade came back readily enough, and the satisfaction of watching her resistance crumble, plus the wine he imbibed, did much to assuage the pain of recent defeats. The girl, her name was Monica, was both lovely and compliant. She met his gaze only coyly at first, but that was all part of the game, and it contented him to play it for a while as a diversion from the coming tragedy. Coy as she was, she didn't reject him when he suggested they take a stroll around the fields of demolished buildings at the back of Shiverick Square, though she made some remark about wanting him to treat her carefully. So he did. They walked together in the darkness until they found a spot where the undergrowth thinned and made a kind of grove. But the sky was clear overhead, and she had a fine, swooning sight of the meteor shower.
"It always makes me feel a little bit afraid," she told him in a charmless cockney. "Looking at the stars, I mean."
"Why is that?"
"Well, we're so small, aren't we?"
He'd asked her earlier to tell him about her life, and she'd volunteered scraps of biography, first about a boy called Trevor who'd said he loved her but had gone off with her best friend, then about her mother's collection of china frogs, and how much she'd liked to live in Spain because everybody was so much happier there. But now, without prompting, she told him she didn't care about Spain or Trevor or the china frogs. She was happy, she said, and the sight of the stars, which usually scared her, tonight made her want to fly. To which he said that they could indeed fly together, if she just said the word. At this, she looked away from the sky with a resigned sigh.
"I know what you want," she said. "You're all the same. Flying. Is that your fancy word for it, then?"
He said she'd misunderstood him completely. He hadn't brought her here to fumble and fuss with her. That was beneath them both.
"What then?" she said.
He answered her with his hand, too swiftly to be contradicted. The second primal act, after the one she'd thought he'd brought her here to perform, her struggles were almost as resigned as her sigh, and she was dead on the ground in less than a minute. Overhead, the stars continued to fall in an abundance he remembered from this time 200 years before, an unseasonal rain of heavenly bodies to presage the business of tomorrow night. He dismembered and disemboweled her with the greatest care, and laid the pieces around the grove in time-honoured fashion. There was no need to hurry. This working was better completed in the bleak moments before dawn, and they were still some hours away. When they came and the working was performed, he had high hopes for it. Godolphin's body had been cold when he'd used it, and its owner scarcely an innocent. The creatures he'd tempted from the inn over with such unappetizing bait had therefore been primitive. Monica, on the other hand, was warm, and had not lived long enough to be much soiled. Her death would open a deeper crack in the Inovo than Godolphin's, and through it he hoped to draw a particular species of oviate uniquely suited for the work tomorrow would bring. A sleek, bitter-throated kind that would help him prove, by tomorrow night, what a child born to destruction could do.
Chapter 17. After all that Monday had said about the state of the city, Jude had expected to find it completely deserted. But this proved not to be the case. In the time between his returning from the South Bank and their setting out for the estate, the streets of London, which were as devoid of romancing tourists and partiers as Monday had claimed, had become the territory of a third and altogether stranger tribe, that of men and women who had simply got up out of their beds and gone wandering. Almost all of them were alone, as though whatever unease had driven them out into the night was too painful to share with their loved ones. Some were dressed for a day at the office, suits and ties, skirts and sensible shoes. Others were wearing the minimum for decency. Many barefoot, many more bare-chested. All wandered with the same languid gait, their eyes turned up to scan the sky. As far as Jude could see, the heavens had nothing untoward to show them. She caught sight of a few shooting stars, but that wasn't so unusual on a clear summer night. She could only assume that these people had in their heads the idea that revelation would come from on high, and, having woken with the irrational suspicion that such revelation was imminent, had gone out to look for it. The scene was not so different when they reached the suburbs. Ordinary men and women in their nightclothes, standing at street corners or on their front lawns, watching the sky. The phenomenon petered out the farther from the centre of London, from Clerkenwell, perhaps, they travelled, only to reappear when they reached the outskirts of the village of Yoke, where, just a few days before, she and Gentle had stood, soaked, in the post office. Passing down the lanes they'd trudged in the rain reminded her of the naive ambition she'd returned into the Fifth bearing, the possibility of some reunion between Gentle and herself. Now she was retracing her route with all such hopes dashed, carrying a child that belonged to his enemy. Her 200-year courtship with Gentle was finally and irredeemably over. The undergrowth around the estate had swelled monstrously, and it took more than the switch Esterbrook had wielded to clear a way to the gates. Despite the fact that it was flourishing, the greenery smelled rank, as if it was decaying as quickly as it was growing, and its buds would not be blossoms, but rot. Thrashing to left and right with his knife, Monday led the way to the gates and through the corrugated iron into the parkland beyond. Though it was an hour for moths and owls, the park was swarming with all manner of daylight life. Birds circled the air as though misdirected by a change in the poles and blind to their nests. Gnats, bees, dragonflies, and all the mazing species of a summer's day flitted in desperate confusion through the moonlit grass. Like the sky-gazers in the streets they'd passed through, nature sensed imminence and could not rest. Jude's own sense of direction served her well, however. Though the copses scattered ahead of them looked much the same in the blue-grey light, she fixed upon the retreat, and they trudged towards it, slowed by the muddy ground and the thickness of the grass. Monday whistled as he went, with that same blissful indifference to melody that Clem had remarked upon a few hours before.
"Do you know what's going to happen tomorrow?" Jude asked him, almost envious of his strange serenity. "Yeah, sort of," he said. "There's these heavens, see? And the boss is going to let us go there. It's going to be amazing."
"Aren't you afraid?" she said.
"What of?"
"Everything's going to change."
"Good," he said. "I'm fucked off with the way things are."
Then he picked up the thread of his whistle again and headed on through the grass for another 100 yards, until a sound more insistent than his din silenced him.
"Listen to that!"
The activity in the air and the grass had steadily increased as they approached the copse, but with the wind blowing in the opposite direction, the din of such an assembly as was gathered there had not been audible until now.
"Birds and bees," Monday remarked, "and a fuck of a lot of them."
As they continued their advance, the scale of the Parliament ahead steadily became more apparent. Though the moonlight did not pierce the foliage very deeply, it was clear that every branch of every tree around the retreat, to the tiniest twiglet, was occupied with birds. The smell of their massing pricked their nostrils, its din their ears.
"We're going to get our heads right royally shat on," Monday said. "Either that, or we'll get stung to death."
The insects were by now a living veil between them and the copse, so thick
that they gave up attempting to flail it aside after a few strides and bore the deaths on their brows and cheeks and the countless flutterings in their hair in order to pick up speed and dash for their destination. There were birds in the grass now, commoners among the Parliament, denied a seat on the branches. They rose in a squawking cloud before the runners, and their alarm caused consternation in the trees. A thunderous ascent began, the mass of life so vast that the violence of its motion beat the tender leaves down. By the time Jude and Monday reached the corner of the copse, they were running through a double rain, one green and falling, the other rising and feathered. Picking up her pace, Jude overtook Monday and headed around the retreat, the walls of which were black with insects, to the door. At the threshold she halted. There was a small fire burning inside, built close to the edge of the mosaic.
"Some bugger got here first," Monday remarked.
"I don't see anyone."
He pointed to a bundle lying on the floor beyond the fire. His eyes, more accustomed than hers to seeing life in rags, had found the fire maker. She stepped into the retreat, knowing before he raised his head who this creature was. How could she not? 3 times before, once here, once in Isordarex, and once, most recently, in the Tabula Rasa's tower, this man had made an unexpected arrival, as though to prove what he'd claimed not so long ago, that their lives would be perpetually interwoven because they were the same.
Dowd?
He didn't move.
"Knife," she said to Monday.
He passed it over, and armed, she advanced across the retreat towards the bundle. Dowd's hands were crossed on his chest as though he expected to expire where he lay. His eyes were closed, but they were the only part of his face that was. Almost every other inch had been laid open by Celestine's assault, and despite his legendary powers of recuperation, he'd been unable to make good the damage done. He was unmasked to the bone, yet he breathed, albeit weakly, and moaned to himself now and then, as though dreaming of punishment or revenge. She was half tempted to kill him in his sleep and have this bitter business brought to an end on the spot, but she was curious to know why he was here. Had he attempted to return to his Isordarex and failed? Or was he expecting someone to come back this way and meet him here? Either could be significant in these volatile times, and though in her present venomous state she felt perfectly capable of dispatching him, he'd always been an agent in the dealings of greater souls, and might still have some fragment of use as a messenger. She went down on her haunches beside him, and spoke his name above the din of birds coming back to roost on the roof. He opened his eyes only slowly, adding their glisten to the wetness of his features.
"Look at you," he said. "You're radiant, lovey."
It was a line from a boulevard comedy, and despite his wretched condition, he spoke it with elan.
"I, of course, look like ordure. Will you come closer to me? I don't have the energy for volume."
She hesitated to comply. Though he was on the verge of extinction, he had boundless capacity for malice in him, and with the pivots, sloughings still fixed in his flesh, the power to do harm.
"I can hear you perfectly well where I am," she said.
"I'm good for 100 words at this volume," he bargained. "Twice that at a whisper."
"What have we got left to say to each other?"
"Ah," he said, "so much. You think you've heard everybody's stories, don't you? Mine, Sartori's, Godolphin's, even the Reconcilers by now. But you're missing one."
"Oh, am I?"
she said, not much caring.
"Whose is that?"
"Come closer."
"I'll hear it from here or not at all."
He looked at her beadily.
"You're a bitch. You really are.
And you're wasting words. If you've got something to say, say it. Whose story am I missing?"
He bided his time before replying, to squeeze what little drama he could out of this. Finally, he said,
"The father's."
"What father?"
"Is there more than one? Apex Amendios, the aboriginal, the unbeheld, he of the first dominion."
"You don't know that story," she said.
He reached up with sudden speed, and his hand was clamped around her arm before she could move out of range. Monday saw the attack and came running, but she halted him before he ploughed into Dowd and sent him back to sit by the fire.
"It's all right," she told him. "He's not going to hurt me. Are you?"
She studied Dowd.
"Well, are you?"
she said again.
"You can't afford to lose me. I'm the last audience you'll have, and you know it. If you don't tell this story to me, you're not going to tell it to anybody. Not this side of hell."
The man quietly conceded her point.
"True,"
he said.
"So tell. Unburden yourself."
He drew a laborious breath. Then he began.
"I saw him once, you know," he said. "The father of the Imagica. He came to me in the desert."
"He appeared in person, did he?"
she said, her skepticism plain.
"Not exactly. I heard him speaking out of the first, but I saw hints, you know, in the erasure."
"And what did he look like?"
"Like a man, from what I could see."
"Or what you imagined?"
"Maybe I did," Dowd said. "But I didn't imagine what he'd told me."
"That he'd raise you up, make you his procurer. You've told me all this before, Dowd."
"Not all of it," he said. "When I'd seen him, I came back to the fifth,
using fates he'd whispered to me to cross the Inovo.
And I searched the length and breadth of London for a woman to be blessed among women."
"And you found Celestine?"
"Yes, I found Celestine. At Tyburn, as a matter of fact. Watching a hanging. I don't know why I chose her. Perhaps because she laughed so hard when the man kissed the noose, and I thought, she's no sentimentalist, this woman. She won't weep and wail if she's taken into another dominion. She wasn't beautiful even then, but she had a clarity, you know. Some actresses have it. The great ones, anyway. A face that could carry extremes of emotion and not look pathetic. Maybe I was a little infatuated with her."
He shivered.
"I was capable of that when I was younger. So I made myself known to her and told her I wanted to show her a living dream, the like of which she'd never forget. She resisted at first, but I could have talked the face off the moon in those days, and she let me drug her with sways and take her away. It was a hell of a journey, 4 months across the Dominions, but I got her there eventually, back to the Erasure."
"And what happened?"
"It opened,
and
I saw the City of God."
Here, at least, was something she wanted to know about.
"What was it like?" she said.
"It was just a glimpse."
Having denied him her proximity for so long, she leaned towards him and repeated her question, inches from his ravaged face.
"What was it like?" "Vast and gleaming and exquisite."
"Gold?"
"All colours. But it was just a glimpse. Then the walls seemed to burst, and something reached for Celestine and took her."
"Did you see what it was?"
"I've tried to remember, over and over. Sometimes I think it was like a net, sometimes like a cloud. I don't know. Whatever it was, it took her."
"You tried to help her, of course," Jude said.
"No, I shat my pants and crawled away. What could I do? She belonged to God. And in the long run, wasn't she the lucky one?
Abducted and raped.
Abducted, raped, and made a little divine. Whereas I, who'd done all the work, what was I?"
"A pimp."
"Yes, a pimp. Anyway, she's had her revenge," he said sourly. "Look at me. She's had more than enough."
That was true. The life both Oscar and Quasar had failed to extinguish in Dowd, Celestine had virtually put out.
"So that's the father's tale?" Jude said.
"I've heard most of it before."
"That's the tale, but what's the moral?"
"You tell me."
He shook his head slightly.
"I don't know whether you're mocking or not."
"I'm listening, aren't I?
Be grateful for small mercies. You could be lying here without an audience.
Well, that's part of it, isn't it? I'm not. You could have come here when I was dead. You could, maybe, not have come here at all, but our lives have collided one last time. That's fate's way of telling me to unburden myself.
Of what?
I'll tell you. Again, a laboured breath. All these years, I've wondered, why did God pluck a scabby little actor chappie up out of the dirt and send him across three dominions to fetch him a woman?
He wanted a reconciler.
And he couldn't find a wife in his own city, Dowd said. Isn't that a little odd? Besides, why does he care whether the Imagicus reconciled or not?
Now that was a good question, she thought. Here was a god who'd sealed himself away in his own city, and showed no desire to lower the wall between his dominion and the rest, yet went to immense lengths to breed a child who would bring all such walls tumbling down.
It's certainly strange, she said.
I'd say so.
Have you got any answers to any of this?
Not really. But I think he must have some purpose, don't you? Or why go to all this trouble?
A plot.
Gods don't plot. They create. They protect. They prescribe.
So which is he doing?
That's the nub of it. Maybe you can find out. Maybe the other reconcilers already did.
The others?
The sons he sent before Sartori. Maybe they realized what he was up to and they defied him.
There was a thought.
Maybe Christos didn't die saving mortal man from his sins.
But from his father?
Yes.
She thought of the scenes she'd glimpsed in the Boston Bowl, the terrible spectacle of the city and most likely the dominion overwhelmed by a great darkness, and her body, that had been driven to fits and convulsions by the torments visited upon her, grew suddenly still. There was no panic, no frenzy. Just a deep, cold dread.
What do I do?
I don't know, lovey. You're free to do whatever you like, remember?
A few hours before, sitting on the step with Clem, her lack of a place in the Gospel of Reconciliation had depressed her spirits. But now it seemed that fact offered her some frail thread of hope. As Dowd had been so eager to claim at the Tower, she belonged to no one. The Godolphins were dead, and so was Quasar. Gentle had gone to walk in the footsteps of Christos, and Sartori was either out building his new Isordorex or digging a hole to die in. She was on her own, and in a world in which everyone else was blinded by obsession and obligation, that was a significant condition. Perhaps only she could see this story remotely now and make a judgment unswayed by fealty.
This is some choice, she said.
Perhaps you'd better forget I even spoke, lovey,
Dowd said. His voice was becoming frailer by the phrase, but he preserved as best he could his jaunty tone.
It's just gossip from an actor, chappie.
If I try and stop the reconciliation,
you'll be flying in the face of the Father, the Son, and probably the Holy Ghost as well.
And if I don't?
You take the responsibility for whatever happens.
Why?
Because.
The power in his voice was now so diminished, the sound of the fire he'd built was louder.
Because I think only you can stop it.
As he spoke, his hand lost its grip on her arm.
Well, he said, that's done.
His eyes began to flicker closed.
One last thing, lovey,
he said.
Yes.
It's maybe asking too much.
What is?
I wonder. Could you forgive me? I know it's absurd, but I don't want to die with you despising me.
She thought of the cruel scene he'd played with Quasar, when her sister had asked for some kindness. While she hesitated, he began whispering again.
We were, just a little, the same, you know?
At this, she put out her hand to touch him and offer what comfort she could, but before her fingers reached him, his breath stopped, and his eyes flickered closed. Jude let out a tiny moan. Against all reason, she felt a pang of loss at Dowd's passing.
"Is something wrong?" Monday said.
She stood up.
"That rather depends on your point of view," she said,
borrowing an air of comedic fatalism from the man at her feet. It was a tone worth rehearsing. She might need it quite a bit in the next few hours.
"Can you spare a cigarette?" she asked Monday.
Monday fished out his pack and lobbed it over. She took one and threw the pack back as she returned to the fire, stooping to pluck up a burning twig to light the tobacco.
"What happened to Fellamy, lad?"
"He's dead.
So what do we do now?"
What indeed? If ever a road divided, it was here. Should she prevent the reconciliation? It wouldn't be difficult, the stones were at her feet, and let history call her a destroyer for doing so? Or should she let it proceed, and risk an end to all histories, and futures, too?
"How long till it's light?" she asked Monday.
The watch he was wearing had been part of the booty he'd brought back to Gamut Street on his first trip. He consulted it with a flourish.
2.5 hours, he said.
There was so little time to act, and littler still to decide on a course. Returning to Clerkenwell with Monday was a cul-de-sac. That at least was certain. Gentle was the Underheld's agent in this, and he wasn't going to be diverted from his father's business now, especially on the word of a man like Dowd, who'd spent his life a stranger to truth. He'd argue that this confession had been Dowd's revenge on the living, a last desperate attempt to spoil a glory he knew he couldn't share. And maybe that was true. Maybe she'd been duped.
"Are we going to collect these stones or what?" Monday said.
"I think we have to,"
she said, still musing.
"What are they for?"
"They're like stepping stones,"
she said, her voice losing momentum as a thought distracted her. Indeed, they were stepping stones. They were a way back to Isorderex, which suddenly seemed like an open road, along which she might yet find some guidance in these last hours to help her make a choice. She threw her cigarette down into the embers.
"You're going to have to take the stones back to Gamut Street on your own, Monday."
"Where are you going?"
"To Isorderex."
"Why?"
"It's too complicated to explain. You just have to swear to me that you'll do exactly as I tell you."
"I'm ready," he said.
"All right, so listen up. When I'm gone, I want you to take the stones back to Gamut Street and carry a message along with them. It has to go to Gentle personally, you understand? Don't trust anybody else with it, even Clem."
"I understand,"
Monday said, beaming with pleasure at this unlooked-for honour.
"What have I got to tell him?"
"Where I've gone, for one thing."
"Isorderex?"
"That's right. Then tell him—"
she pondered for a moment.
"Tell him the reconciliation isn't safe, and he mustn't start the working until I contact him again."
"It isn't safe, and he mustn't start the working until I contact him again. I've got that. Is there any more?"
"That's it," she said.
"Now all I've got to do is find the circle."
She started to scan the mosaic, looking for the subtle differences in tone that marked the stones. From past experience, she knew that once they'd been lifted from their niches, the Isorderexian Express would be underway, so she told Monday to wait outside until she'd gone. He looked worried now, but she told him she'd come to no harm.
"It's not that," he said. "I want to know what the message means. If you're telling the boss it's not safe, does that mean he won't open the Dominions?"
"I don't know."
"But I want to see Parashokwa and Limby and Isorderex," he said,
listing the places like charms.
"I know that," she said. "And believe me, I want the Dominions opened just as much as you do."
She studied his face in the dying firelight, looking for some clue as to whether he was being placated, but for all his youth he was a master of concealment. She'd have to trust that he'd put his duties as a messenger above his desire to see the Imagicka and relay the spirit of her warning, if not its precise text.
"You've got to make Gentle understand the danger he's in,"
she said, hoping this tack would make him conscientious.
"I will,"
he said, now faintly irritated by her insistence. She let the subject lie and returned to the business of finding the stones. He didn't offer his assistance, but retreated to the door from which he said, "How will you get back?" She'd found four of the stones already, and the birds on the roof had set up a fresh cacophony, suggesting that they felt some tremor of change below.
"I'll deal with that problem when I get to it," she replied.
The birds suddenly rose up, and, unnerved, Monday stepped out of the retreat altogether. Jude glanced up at him as she dug out another stone. The fire between them had already been fanned into flame, and now its ashes were stirred up, rising in a smutty cloud to hide the door from view. She scanned the mosaic, checking to see if she'd missed a stone, but the itches and aches she remembered from her first crossing were already creeping through her body, proof that the passing place was about its work. Oscar had told her, on this very spot, that the discomforts of passage diminished with repetition, and his words proved correct. She had time, as the walls blurred around her, to glimpse the door through the swirling ash and realize, all too late, that she should have looked out at the world one last time before leaving it. Then the retreat disappeared, and the Inovo's delirium was oppressing her, its prisoners rising in their legions to claim her. Travelling alone, she went more quickly than she had with Oscar, at least that was her impression, and she was out the other side before the Oviats had time to sniff the heels of her glyph. The walls of the merchant Peckable's cellar were brighter than she remembered them. The reason? A lamp which burned on the floor a yard from the circle, and beyond it a figure, its face a blur, which came at her with a bludgeon, and laid her unconscious on the floor before she'd uttered a word of explanation.
Chapter 18. 1. The mantle of night was falling on the Fifth Dominion, and Gentle found Tikraw near the summit of the Mount of Lipabaic, watching the last dusky colours of day drop from the sky. He was eating while he did so, a bowl each of sausage and pickle between his feet, and a large pot of mustard between these, into which meat and vegetable alike were plunged. Though Gentle had come here as a projection, his body left sitting cross-legged in the meditation room in Gamut Street, he didn't need nose or palate to appreciate the piquancy of Raw's meal. Imagination sufficed. He looked up when Gentle approached, unperturbed by the phantom watching him eat.
"You're early, aren't you?"
he remarked, glancing at his pocket watch, which hung from his coat on a piece of string.
"We've got hours yet."
"I know. I just came
to check up on me,"
Tikraw said, the sting of pickle in his voice.
"Well, I'm here. Are you ready in the Fifth?"
"We're getting there," Gentle said, somewhat queasily. Though he'd travelled this way countless times as the Maestro Sartori, his mind, empowered by fate, carrying his image and his voice across the dominions, and had reacquainted himself with the technique easily enough, the sensation was damn strange.
"What do I look like?"
he asked Tikraw, remembering as he spoke how he'd attempted to describe the mistiff on these very slopes.
"Insubstantial," Tikraw replied, squinting up at him, then returning to his meal. "Which is fine by me, because there's not enough sausage for two."
"I'm still getting used to what I'm capable of."
"Well, don't take too long about it," Tikraw said. "We've got work to do."
"And I should have realized that you were part of that work when I was first here. But I didn't, and for that I apologize."
"Accepted," Tikraw said.
"You must have thought I was crazy."
"You certainly, how shall I put this, you certainly confounded me. It took me days to work out why you were so damn obstreperous. Pi talked to me, you know, tried to make me understand. But I've been waiting for somebody to come from the Fifth for so long, I was only listening with half an ear."
"I think Pi probably hoped my meeting with you would make me remember who the hell I was."
"How long did it take?"
"Months."
"Was it the mistiff who hid you from yourself in the first place?"
"Yes, of course."
"Well, it did too good a job. That'll teach it. Where's your flesh and blood, by the way?"
"Back in the Fifth."
"Take my advice. Don't leave it too long. I find the bowels mutiny, and you come back to find you're sitting in shite. Of course, that could be a personal weakness."
He selected another sausage and chewed on it as he asked Gentle why the hell he'd let the mistiff make him forget. "I was a coward," Gentle replied. "I couldn't face my failure."
"It's hard," Tikraw said. I've lived all these years wondering if I could have saved my maestro Utamaski if I'd been quicker-witted. I still miss him.
I'm responsible for what happened to him, and I've no excuses.
We've all got our frailties, maestro. My bowels, your cowardice. None of us is perfect. But I presume your being here means we're finally going to have another try?
That's my intention, yes.
Again, Tick-Raw looked at his watch, doing a mute calculation as he chewed.
20 of your 5th Dominion hours from now, or thereabouts.
That's right.
Well, you'll find me ready,
he said, consuming a sizable pickle in one bite.
Do you have anyone to help you?
His mouth full, all Tick could manage was,
Not need 'em,
he chewed on, then swallowed.
Nobody even knows I'm here,
he explained.
I'm still wanted by the law, even though I hear his Orderex is in ruins.
It's true.
I also hear the pivot's quite transformed,
Tick-Raw said.
Is that right?
Into what?
Nobody can get near enough to find out, he replied. But if you're planning to check on the whole synod...
I am.
Then maybe you'll see for yourself while you're in the city. There was a Yerhath Temek representing the second, if I remember.
He's dead.
So who's there now?
I'm hoping Scopeek's found someone.
He's in the third, isn't he? At the pivot pit?
That's right.
And who's at the Erasure?
A man called Chika Jakin.
I've never heard of him, Tick-Raw said. Which is odd. I get to hear about most maestros. Are you sure he's a maestro?
Certainly.
Tick-Raw shrugged.
I'll meet him in the Ana, then. And don't worry about me, Sartori. I'll be here.
I'm glad we've made our peace.
I fight over food and women, but never metaphysics, Tick-Raw said. Besides, we've joined in a great mission. This time tomorrow you'll be able to walk home from here.
Their exchange ended on that optimistic note, and Gentle left Tick to his night watch, heading with a thought towards the Quem, where he hoped to find Scopeek keeping his place beside the site of the pivot. He would have been there in the time it took to think himself over the border between dominions, but he allowed his journey to be diverted by memory. His thoughts turned to Beatrix as he left the Mount of Lipperbiac, and it was there, rather than the Quem, his spirit flew to, arriving on the outskirts of the village. It was night here too, of course. Doikai lowed softly on the dark slopes around him, their neck bells tinkling. Beatrix itself was silent, however, the lamps that had flickered in the groves around the houses gone, and the children who'd tended them gone too, all extinguished. Distressed by this melancholy sight, Gentle almost fled the village there and then, but that he glimpsed a single light in the distance, and advancing a little way, saw a figure he recognized crossing the street, his lamp held high. It was Coaxial Tasco, the hermit of the hill who'd granted Pi and Gentle the means to dare the Joker Lelau. Tasco paused halfway across the street and raised his lamp, peering out into the darkness.
Is somebody there?
He asked. Gentle wanted to speak, to make his peace, as he had with Tick-Raw, and to talk about the promise of tomorrow, but the expression on Tasco's face forbade him. The hermit wouldn't thank him for apologies, Gentle thought, or for talk of a bright new day, not when there were so many who'd never see it. If Tasco had some inkling of his visitor, he also judged a meeting pointless. He simply shuddered, lowered his lamp, and moved on about his business. Gentle didn't linger another minute, but turned his face up towards the mountains and thought himself away, not just from Beatrix, but from the Dominion. The village vanished, and the dusty daylight of the Quem appeared around him. Of the four sites where he hoped to find his fellow maestros, the Mount, the Quem, the Yerhatemic Kesperat, and the Erasure, this was the only one he hadn't visited in his travels with Pi, and he'd been prepared to have some difficulty locating the spot. But Scopeek's presence was a beacon in this wasteland. Though the wind raised blinding clouds of dust, he found the man within a few moments of his arrival, squatting in the shelter of a primitive blind constructed from a few blankets hung on poles which were stuck in the grey earth. Uncomfortable though it was, Scopeek had suffered worse privations in his life as a seditionist, not least his incarceration in the Maison de Santé, and when he rose to meet Gentle it was with the brio of a fit and contented man. He was dressed immaculately in a three-piece suit and bow tie, and his face, despite the peculiarity of his features, the nose that was barely two holes in his head, the popping eyes, was much less pinched than it had been. His cheeks made florid by the gritty wind. Like Tick Raw, he was expecting his visitor.
"Come in, come in," he said. "Not that you're feeling the wind much, eh?"
Though this was true, the wind blew through Gentle in the most curious way, eddying around his navel. He joined Scopeek in the lee of his blankets, and there they sat down to talk. As ever, Scopeek had a good deal to say, and poured his tales and observations out in a seamless monologue. He was ready, he said, to represent this dominion in the sacred space of the Anna, though he wondered how the equilibrium of the working would be affected by the absence of the pivot. It had been set at the centre of the five dominions, he reminded Gentle, to be a conduit and perhaps an interpreter of power through the Imagica. Now it was gone, and the third was undoubtedly the weaker for its removal.
"Look,"
he said, standing up and leading his phantom visitor out to the tip of the pit.
"I'm left conjuring beside a hole in the ground."
"Do you think that'll affect the working?"
"Who knows? We're all amateurs pretending to be experts. All I can do is cleanse the place of its previous occupant and hope for the best."
He directed Gentle's attention away from the pit, to the smoking shell of a sizable building which was only occasionally visible through the dust. "What was that?" Gentle asked.
"The bastard's palace."
"And who destroyed it?"
"I did, of course," Scopeek said. "I didn't want his handiwork looming over our working. This is going to be a delicate operation as it is, without his filthy influence fucking it up. It looked like a bordello."
He turned his back on it.
"We should have had months to prepare for this, not hours."
"I realize that.
And then there's the problem of the second. You know, Pi charged me with finding a replacement. I'd have liked to discuss all of this with you, of course, but when we last met, you were in a fugue state, and Pi forbade me to acquaint you with who you were, though, may I be honest?"
"Could I stop you?"
"No, I was sorely tempted to slap you out of it."
Scopeek looked at Gentle fiercely, as though he might have done so now if Gentle had been material enough.
"You caused the Mistiff so much grief, you know," he said, "and like a damned fool it loved you anyway."
"I had my reasons," Gentle said softly. "But you were talking about this replacement."
"Ah, yes, Athanasius."
"Athanasius?"
"He's now our man in his orderix, representing the second. Don't look so appalled. He knows the ceremony and he's completely committed to it."
"There's not a sane bone in his body, Scopeek. He thought I was Hepeximendios's agent."
"Well, of course that's nonsense.
He tried to kill me with Madonnas. He's crazy."
"We've all had our moments, Sartori."
"Don't call me that."
"Athanasius is one of the most holy men I've ever met."
"How can he believe in the Holy Mother one moment and claim he's Jesus the next?"
"He can believe in his own mother, can't he?"
"Are you seriously saying
that Athanasius is literally the resurrected Christos?"
"No.
If we have to have a messiah among us, I vote for you."
He sighed.
"Look, I realize you have difficulties with Athanasius, but I ask you, who else was I to find? There aren't that many maestros left, Sartori."
"I told you—"
"Yes, yes, you don't like the name. Well, forgive me, but for as long as I live, you'll be the maestro Sartori. And if you want to find somebody else to sit here instead of me who'll call you something prettier, find him."
"Were you always this bloody-minded?" Gentle replied.
"No," said Scopeek. "It's taken years of practice."
Gentle shook his head in despair. "Athanasius, it's a nightmare."
"Don't be so sure he hasn't got the spirit of Jesus in him, by the way," Scopeek said. "Stranger things have been known."
"Any more of this," Gentle said, "and I'll be as crazy as he is.
Athanasius, this is a disaster."
Furious, he left Scopeek at the blind and moved off through the dust, trailing imprecations as he went, the optimism with which he'd set out on his journey severely bruised. Rather than appear in front of Athanasius with his thoughts so chaotic, he found a spot on the Lenten Way to ponder. The situation was far from encouraging. Tick Raw was holding his position on the mount as an outlaw, still in danger of arrest. Scopeek was in doubt as to the efficacy of his place now that the pivot had been removed, and now, of all people to join the synod, Athanasius, a man without the wit to come out of the rain.
"Oh, God, Pye," Gentle murmured to himself, "I need you now."
The wind blew mournfully along the highway as he loitered, gusting towards the place of passage between the Third and Second Dominions, as if to usher him with it on towards Isordorex. But he resisted its coaxing, taking time to examine the options available to him. There were, he decided, three. One, to abandon the reconciliation right away before the frailties he saw in the system were compounded and brought on another tragedy. Two, to find a maestro who could replace Athanasius. Three, to trust Scopeek's judgment and go into Isordorex to make his peace with the man. The first of these options was not to be seriously countenanced. This was his father's business, and he had a sacred duty to perform it. The second, the finding of a replacement for Athanasius, was impractical in the time remaining, which left the third. It was unpalatable, but it seemed to be unavoidable. He'd have to accept Athanasius into the synod. The decision made, he succumbed to the message of the gusts, and at a thought went with them along the straight road, through the gap between the dominions, and across the delta into the city god's entrails. 2.
Hoi polloi!
Peckable's daughter had put down her bludgeon and was kneeling beside Jude with tears pouring from her crossed eyes.
"I'm sorry, I'm so sorry," she kept saying. "I didn't know, I didn't know."
Jude sat up. A team of bell ringers was tuning up between her temples, but she was otherwise unharmed.
"What are you doing here?"
she asked Hoi polloi.
"I thought you'd gone with your father."
"I did,"
she explained, fighting the tears,
"but I lost him at the causeway. There were so many people trying to find a way over. One minute he was beside me, and the next he'd vanished. I stayed there for hours looking for him. Then I thought he'd be bound to come back here to the house, so I came back too."
"But he wasn't here."
"No."
She started to sob again, and Jude put her arms around her, murmuring condolences.
"I'm sure he's still alive," Hoi polloi said. "He's just being sensible and staying undercover. It's not safe out there."
She cast a nervous glance up towards the cellar roof.
"If he doesn't come back after a few days, maybe you can take me to the fifth and he can follow."
"It's no safer there than it is here, believe me."
"What's happening to the world?"
Hoi polloi wanted to know.
"It's changing," Jude said, "and we have to be ready for the changes, however strange they are."
"I just want things the way they were. Papa and the business and everything in its place."
"Tulips on the dining room table."
"Yes."
"It's not going to be that way for quite a while," Jude said. "In fact, I'm not sure it'll ever be that way again."
She got to her feet.
"Where are you going?"
Hoi polloi said.
"You can't leave."
"I'm afraid I've got to. I came here to work. If you want to come with me, you're welcome, but you'll have to be responsible for yourself."
Hoi polloi sniffed hard.
"I understand," she said.
"Will you come?"
"I don't want to be alone," she replied. "I'll come."
Jude had been prepared for the scenes of devastation awaiting them beyond the door of Peckable's house, but not for the sense of rapture that accompanied them. Though there were sounds of lamentation rising from somewhere nearby, and that grief was doubtless being echoed in innumerable houses across the city, there was another message on the balmy noonday air.
"What are you smiling at?"
Hoi polloi asked her. She hadn't been aware she was doing so until the girl pointed it out.
"I suppose because it feels like a new day," she said, aware as she spoke that it was also very possibly the last.
Perhaps this brightness in the city's air was its acknowledgement of that, the final remission of a sickened soul before decline and collapse. She voiced none of this to Hoi polloi, of course. The girl was already terrified enough. She walked a step behind Jude as they climbed the street, her fretful murmurs punctuated by hiccups. Her distress would have been profounder still if she'd been able to sense the confusion in Jude, who had no clue, now that she was here, as to where to find the instruction she'd come in search of. The city was no longer a labyrinth of enchantments, if indeed it had ever been that. It was a virtual wasteland, its countless fires now guttering out but leaving a pall overhead. The comet's light pierced these grimy skirts in several places, however, and where its beams fell one colour from the air, like fragments of stained glass shimmering in solution above the griefs below.
Having no better place to head for, Jude directed them towards the nearest of these spots, which was no more than half a mile away. Long before they'd reached the place, a faint drizzle was carried their way by the breeze, and the sound of running water announced the phenomenon's source. The street had cracked open, and either a burst water main or a spring was bubbling up from the tarmac. The sight had brought a number of spectators from the ruins, though very few were venturing close to the water, their fear not of the uncertain ground, but of something far stranger. The water issuing from the crack was not running away down the hill, but up it, leaping the steps that occasionally broke the slope with a salmon's zeal. The only witnesses unafraid of this mystery were the children, several of whom had wrested themselves from their parents' grip and were playing in the law-defying stream, some running in it, others sitting in the water to let it play over their legs. In the little shrieks they uttered, Jude was sure she heard a note of sexual pleasure.
"What is this?"
Hoi Polloi said, her tone more offended than astonished, as though the sight had been laid on as a personal affront to her.
"Why don't we follow it and find out?" Jude replied. "Those children are going to drown,"
Hoi Polloi observed, somewhat primly.
"In 2 inches of water? Don't be ridiculous."
With this, Jude set off, leaving Hoi Polloi to follow if she so wished. She apparently did, because she once again fell into step behind Jude, her hiccups now abated, and they climbed in silence until, 200 yards or more from where they'd first encountered the stream, a second appeared. This from another direction entirely, and large enough to carry a light freight from the lower slopes. The bulk of the cargo was debris. Items of clothing, a few drowned graviolents, some slices of burned bread. But among this trash were objects clearly set upon the stream to be carried wherever it was going. Boat missives of carefully folded paper, small wreaths of woven grass, set with tiny flowers, a doll laid on a little flood in a shroud of ribbons. Jude plucked one of the paper boats out of the water and unfolded it. The writing inside was smeared but legible. "Tishalulay," the letter read. "My name is Simara Sakeo. I send this prayer for my mother and for my father and for my brother Boem, who is dead. I have seen you in dreams, Tishalulay, and know you are good. You are in my heart. Please be also in the hearts of my mother and father and give them your comfort." Jude passed the letter over to Hoi Polloi, her gaze following the course of the married streams.
"Who's Tishalulay?" she asked.
Hoi Polloi didn't reply. Jude glanced around at her to find that the girl was staring up the hill.
"Tishalulay?"
Jude said again.
"She's a goddess,"
Hoi Polloi replied, her voice lowered, although there was nobody within earshot. She dropped the letter onto the ground as she spoke, but Jude stooped to pick it up.
"We should be careful of people's prayers," she said,
refolding the boat and letting it return to its voyage.
"She'll never get it,"
Hoi Polloi said.
"She doesn't exist." "Yet you refuse to say her name out loud." "We are not supposed to name any of the goddesses. Papa taught us that. It's forbidden." "There are others, then?" "Oh, yes. There's the Sisters of the Delta. And Papa said there's even one called Jokalelau, who lived in the mountains." "Where does Tishalulay come from?" "The cradle of Jesamit, I think. I'm not sure."
"The cradle of what?"
"It's a lake in the Third Dominion."
This time Jude knew she was smiling. "Rivers, snows, and lakes," she said, going down on her haunches beside the stream and putting her fingers into it.
"They've come in the waters, Hoi Polloi."
"Who have?"
The stream was cool and played against Jude's fingers, leaping up against her palm.
"Don't be obtuse," she said. "The goddesses, they're here."
"That's impossible. Even if they still existed, and Papa told me they don't, why would they come here?"
Jude lifted a cupped handful of water to her lips and supped. It tasted sweet.
"Perhaps somebody called them," she said.
She looked at Hoi Polloi, whose face was still registering her distaste at what Jude had just done.
"Somebody up there?"
the girl said.
"Well, it takes a lot of effort to climb a hill," Jude said, "especially for water. It's not heading up there because it likes the view. Somebody's pulling it, and if we go with it, sooner or later..."
"I don't think we should do that,"
Hoi Polloi replied.
"It's not just the water that's being called," Jude said. "We are too. Can't you feel it?"
"No,"
the girl said bluntly.
I could turn around now and go back home. Is that what you want to do?
Hoi Polloi looked at the river running a yard from her foot. As luck would have it, the water was carrying some of its less lovely cargo past them, a flotilla of chicken heads and the partially incinerated carcass of a small dog.
You drank that, Hoi Polloi said.
It tasted fine, Jude said, but looked away as the dog went by. The sight had confirmed Hoi Polloi in her unease.
I think I will go home, she said. I'm not ready to meet goddesses, even if they are up there. I've sinned too much.
That's absurd, said Jude. This isn't about sin and forgiveness. That kind of nonsense is for the men. This is... She faltered, uncertain of the vocabulary, then said,
This is wiser than that. How do you know?
Hoi Polloi replied.
Nobody really understands these things, even Papa. He used to tell me he knew how the comet was made, but he didn't. It's the same with you and these goddesses.
Why are you so afraid?
If I wasn't, I'd be dead. And don't condescend to me. I know you think I'm ridiculous, but if you were a bit politer, you'd hide it.
I don't think you're ridiculous.
Yes, you do.
No. I just think you loved your papa a little too much. There's no crime in that. Believe me, I've made the same mistake myself. Over and over again. You trust a man, and the next thing...
She sighed, shaking her head.
Never mind. Maybe you're right. Maybe you should go home. Who knows? Perhaps he'll be waiting for you. What do I know?
They turned their backs on each other without further word, and Jude headed on up the hill, wishing as she went that she'd found a more tactful way of stating her case. She'd climbed 50 yards when she heard the soft pad of Hoi Polloi's step behind her, then the girl's voice, its rebuking tone gone, saying,
Papa's not going to come home, is he?
Jude turned back, meeting Hoi Polloi's cross-eyed gaze as best she could.
No, she said. I don't think he is.
Hoi Polloi looked at the cracked ground beneath her feet.
I think I've always known that, she said, but I just haven't been able to admit it.
Now she looked up again, and contrary to Jude's expectation, was dry-eyed. Indeed, she almost looked happy, as though she was lighter for this admission.
We're both alone now, aren't we?
She said.
Yes, we are. So maybe we should go on together, for both our sakes.
Thank you for thinking of me, Jude said.
We women should stick together,
Hoi Polloi replied,
and came to join Jude as she resumed the climb. 3. To Gentle's eye, Isordrex looked like a fever dream of itself. A dark borealis hung above the palace, but the streets and squares were everywhere visited by wonders. Rivers sprang from the fractured pavements and danced up the mountainside, spitting their clime in gravity's face. A nimbus of colour painted the air over each of the springing places, bright as a flock of parrots. It was a spectacle he knew Pi would have revelled in, and he made a mental note of every strangeness along the way, so that he could paint the scene in words when he was back at the Mistiff's side. But it wasn't all wonders. These prisms and waters rose amid scenes of utter devastation, where keening widows sat, barely distinguishable from the blackened rubble of their houses. Only the Yerhatemic Kesperat, at the gates of which he presently stood, seemed to be untouched by the fire-raisers. There was no sign of any inhabitant, however, and Gentle wandered for several minutes, silently honing a fresh set of insults for Scopeek, when he caught sight of the man he'd come to find. Athanasius was standing in front of one of the trees that lined the boulevards of the Kesperat, staring up at it admiringly. Though the foliage was still in place, the arrangement of branches it grew upon was visible, and Gentle didn't have to be an aspirant Christos to see how readily a body might be nailed to them. He called Athanasius's name several times as he approached, but the man seemed lost in reverie and didn't look around, even when Gentle was at his shoulder.